What I want to talk to you about today, it'll be a very intimate discussion today, is just talking more about chiral perturbation theory for the meson mass spectrum, and then a little bit about meson decay and mixing and how we use that to study the CKM matrix, and then this flavor problem for new physics that is basically related to the testing these CKM elements. So just to remind you, because we talked about it a while ago, in the standard model, we have the Yukawa terms for the Higgs, giving masses to the quarks. And when the Higgs takes on its vacuum expectation value, you get V over square root of 2. And then you have your left and right-handed fields for the ups and the downs plus the Hermitian conjugate. We rotated to mass eigenstate fields by these rotations we introduced, and we talked about these a couple of times, but I just want to have a complete discussion so you see exactly what we're testing in these meson decays. So we rotate the lefts and the rights by individual SU3 rotations to take these Yukawas, which are matrices in this case, 3x3 matrices that are complex, to their mass diagonal form. Okay, so that gives the masses. But there's one rotation, there's an overlap matrix that's present when we do this for the left-handed fields, because when we rotate the up left and the down left, or the equivalent case for the leptons, then we don't rotate both components of the doublet in the same way. So we pull out an overall normalization of rotating the lefts, and then we get a CKM matrix here that's then hitting the downs, okay? Or VCKM, to be very explicit, is just this dagger which cancels this one off for this entry, and then this down rotation. So we talked about this before, but I'm just reminding you, because we're gonna get into testing these things in terms of meson decays. Okay, so when we have the CKM matrix, it shows up in this kinetic term. So this kinetic term, we expand it out. We rotate to the mass eigenstate fields for the W. Then we have ups and downs. Then the raising and lowering operators that are present in the covariant derivative, multiplying the W since we're in mass eigenstates, give us ups and then down contributions. Because it's ups and then down contributions, when we rotate to the mass eigenstates for the W interaction, we get the CKM matrix, right? Because you get a down rotation and up rotation, which is exactly this. And this is all just to remind you, we discussed this before. Okay, so this is flavor-changing charge currents at tree level, okay? So the standard model has a specific flavor-changing structure. It has these large groups which are present for the kinetic terms, and it's breaking, and this is an explicit form of breaking of flavor symmetry, of flavor effects that is coming in with the charge currents. Okay, so far, just a reminder of how that works. Okay, so the CKM matrix, just expanded out, if you just expand it out in terms of the individual entries it can have, multiplying the W, so when you have an up and a down, or an up and a strange, an up and a bottom, you get these individual entries for the CKM matrix. It looks like there's 9 independent entries for the matrix, and it's characterizing the relative strength of how the W makes these pairs of quarks. But there's only 4 parameters, remember, because this is an n by n matrix. We can rephase the quark fields. The relative rephasing of the quark fields lets us remove some of the parameters you might think is there, and it reduces to be n minus 1 all squared in terms of the number of parameters. So those 4 parameters mean that these are not all independent. We break down this matrix, it looks like this is an independent set of parameters that we can measure all separately, but they're actually related to one another. And one thing that people do in testing flavor physics and the properties of mesons and meson decay is they're looking exactly for that expected relationship between these parameters measured in all sorts of different decays and then combined up in a global fit to see if it's a consistent description of flavor change and also the weak and mass eigenstate relations. So those 4 parameters are not all independent, so you can define one of them. You can choose VUS to be something we call lambda, We could define another parameter relatively to be VCB, which is exactly what was done. And then you can relate those two parameters to the other parameters in this rotation matrix. And if you do that, you get something called the Wolfenstein parameterization. Which is just given here. So this is the lambda we defined. This is this A lambda squared. And this is just a normalization choice. And then how do we get these other expressions? We get these other terms by basically taking the conditions that the CKM matrix is unitary and applying them to derive these other entries. Okay, so the other entries we derive from just taking this matrix in its diagonal. And it basically it has to be 1 1 1 0 0 0 0. Okay? This is a unitary transformation matrix from one set of eigenstates to another set of eigenstates, the weak to the mass eigenstates. So it has to satisfy this condition. So if we introduce this parameter and this parameter and we make those conditions be satisfied, then we can derive the other terms that we have. Plus higher order effects, because we're doing also an expansion in lambda here. We're doing an expansion in lambda because these are small parameters. And this is all going to, you know, get into the flavor structure of the case of the standard model and how it's broken by these interactions, how the flavor symmetry is broken in a very specific pattern, which we're testing to very high precision experimentally. This should be just a half lambda squared. So this you have to fit experimentally, we don't know, but it turns out this is a very powerful and useful parameterization because essentially lambda is small, okay? All right, so far so good, just reminding you about that and fleshing out a little bit what we talked about before. Okay, now, we have right there so far, the source of flavor-changing effects in the standard model, right? So it's just a tree-level interaction with this overlap matrix, with the W. So you could ask yourself, what about neutral currents? Right? The W gives flavor change. What about the photon, and what about the Z? Right? They couple the fermion pairs as well. What about I and J there and I and J there? Well, remember the way we defined the CKM matrix was this overlap between ups and downs. So you might just think it's just trivial that you need to have, you know, the overlap matrices appearing there so that you only get the CKM matrix there. But you can also just understand it from the sake of generators, right? The Z and the photon are rotations from W3 and B. Okay? And those generators, we know them. And they essentially they're diagonal, even though they have a minus one in one case and 1 1 in the other case. So those diagonals being diagonal, they commute with these rotations of the right-handed fields and the left-handed fields, which is another way of saying the same thing, that you need the up-down to give you the overlap matrix. Okay, so these generators commute at tree level. And so because they commute at tree level, there's no off-diagonal effects like this, is another way of saying it, then we get no flavor-changing neutral currents at tree level. Okay, so there's no off-diagonal IJ here for the photon or the Z. And we test that experimentally very precisely. But it's important for you to understand, because of what we're going to talk about next, in terms of meson decays, that's a tree-level statement. That's a tree-level argument of generator commutation. And you can have a Z, for example, we talked about a lot of Z decays, and you could dress it with a W interaction. Okay? So if you put the W here, you can have off-diagonal I's and J's that are present. So this is a tree-level statement alone. Okay, but the flavor change fundamentally is coming from the charge-current interaction, but it's at one loop. And it gives a very specific pattern of decays involving the final states I and J, for the Z, and also the masses of the fermions. Okay, because it's always coming from the W, it's very predictive, even at loop level. Okay. So even at loop level, we do get these effects. They're just so small that they're, you know, subdominant contributions to the dominant decay modes of mesons and Zs and that sort of thing. But you should be careful that these effects are around. It's just as a very predictive pattern involving the W and loop corrections. Okay, because whenever you have the W, it's not just that there's a loop factor, there's also the masses, because there's chirality, right, because it's P lefts. So you get mass factors. And you also have specifically the CKM matrix elements that are appearing here. Okay? So there are flavor-changing currents at loop level that are neutral. But they all follow fundamentally from the W. Okay. So this is all clear? I'm supposed to just be reminding you of this for the most part. Okay, so keep this in mind. And what we're going to do now is we're going to go back to talking about chiral symmetry and how it makes us, like, let us understand the mass spectrum of mesons. And then we're going to think about meson decays to basically extract tests of the CKM matrix, which is not appearing here. But it's going to be how we fundamentally are going after all these different entries of the CKM matrix to look to see if this is a consistent description of all the stuff we see in terms of meson decays and meson mixing. And it's all going to follow this pattern. Okay. So hopefully that's clear. Okay. So we started talking about this yesterday, but I wanted to just go over it and make it clear and then step to the sort of decays that I want to talk about in the mass spectrum. Okay, so chiral symmetry breaking. So the idea here is we want to understand the mass spectrum of the bound states. We want to understand how to think about the mesons and then how they're decaying with this very predictive pattern of neutral and charged currents having these off-diagonal effects in flavor. Okay? So if we start with the standard model QCD Lagrangian, all we're going to be doing, and these are now mass eigenstate fields, is we're going to be neglecting the mass. Okay, so we've already rotated to mass eigenstates following what we were talking about over there. Q is just an up-down strange because we're thinking about the quarks in a triplet where their masses are smaller than lambda QCD. Okay, so there should be some expansion of these masses being smaller than lambda QCD. So we're going to do perturbation theory. We're going to say this goes to zero. And then we're going to expand and perturb inserting the mass matrix and just see what we get for a perturbed mass spectrum for the mesons. And the masses are diagonal, so they're already the up, the down, and the strange mass. Okay, so whenever I say MQ, it's actually a 3x3 matrix of this form because we're in mass eigenstates. Okay, so in this limit where we take MQ goes to zero, we have a very large flavor symmetry group. We have the left-handed rotations that we can do separately, the right-handed rotations that we can do separately on the ups and the downs. So this is usually called, it's actually a U3 to the fifth symmetry group. This is just the quark part of it. So what it is actually the full symmetry group is U3 to the fifth, which has these three individual rotations, SU's, threes. There's three U1s as well that I'm pulling out here. And then there's two other U3s for the lepton sector, which you can decompose into two SU3s for the lepton, left-handed doublets and the right-handed guys, and then the U1s that you pull out there. So what we say in the standard model is there's a very large symmetry group just in the kinetic terms for the flavor symmetry. And then it breaks down due to these interactions. And because it breaks down due to such a specific set of interactions that have this structure fundamentally for off-diagonal I's and J's, and that even when you start to do loops, it fundamentally has to come from the charge current, you get this very predictive pattern in terms of how flavor symmetry is broken down into subgroups. Okay? And it all follows from fundamentally just this effect. So we want to test that symmetry breaking pattern. Okay? So in the case of just the quarks, for the chiral symmetry breaking discussion, we have an SU3 left up, we have an SU3 right up and down. Sorry, that should be Q. And this is this large flavor symmetry that we have. So it's all due to this VCKM, fundamentally, that symmetry breaking. Okay, so, but that's in the standard model. For many, many years, first of all, we didn't have a full understanding of the symmetry breaking structure of the standard model. The standard model is a hypothesis, which seems to fit the data. People came up with the CKM matrix idea, I think it was in the late 70s, when they were trying to figure out multiple ways of having flavor change in the standard model and CP violating effects. And these guys, eventually, the three of them got a Nobel Prize a couple of years ago when it was validated, okay? So this is, you know, a non-trivial hypothesis of the structure of the standard model that we want to test. We don't just want to assume it. Okay, so it's super predictive. And there's something called the GYM mechanism, which is what I want to get to today, which has to do with how this flavor breaking is showing up in meson decays and also in meson oscillations, which is mesons changing to other mesons. Okay, it's a highly predictive pattern of symmetry breaking. Okay. So, first though, let's make sure we can understand the mass spectrum of the mesons, which we'll then study the decays of and the oscillations of. Okay, so this bilinear in quark fields has a lower energy than a free quark. It's just because if you try and take a quark out to infinity, that takes an infinite amount of energy, so bound states have a lower energy. So this bound state leads to a lower energy of the system that you want to expand around. So it has a vacuum expectation value due to QCD. It's not zero, it's dimension three. And so we just define it as this V prime. V prime just because this is not the 246 GeV of the standard model. Okay, this is a different V. It's a VeV, it's dimension three, and it's of order lambda QCD cubed. Remember, lambda QCD was this scale that came in from the strong coupling and the running of the strong coupling. It's a scale that's dynamically generated by the running of the theory. It's about a GeV. And simply because this is just due to QCD, it's the only scale there, and it's dynamically generated. Remember, we're thinking about this in the massless limit to start with for the quarks. So this is just of order lambda QCD, right? Kind of by definition. What else could it be? Just dimensional analysis. So it's just defined that way. So we introduce this field, this sigma field, when we start to think about chiral symmetry and how it's broken. And its purpose in life is to parameterize this condensate, this set of condensate that you get when you start to think about the, you know, the bound states of the down and the S. And we want it to be dimensionless, just as a choice, so we introduce it with a V prime normalization so that when we take the expectation value of the quarks, this thing is dimensionless, okay? It's just a parameterization of symmetry breaking. Okay, so it's dimensionless and it's also diagonal. That's just by choice as well. Okay, so we're constructing it to be by choice a diagonal parameterization. Okay, so if we have the expectation value of this field is just this diagonal, and initially, it had the property that it was transforming on the left and the right in this way, then just like in the case of custodial symmetry, which we talked about, which was very similar, remember in the case of custodial symmetry, the analogy is quite exact, that there was this bidoublet field we made that transforms on the left and then the right. And then we took this to a diagonal subgroup, and then that made us have the, you know, the SU2 left cross SU2 right break down to an SU2 vectorial. Okay? So the diagonal expectation value of this just means that you still have the symmetry when the left and the right transformations are identified, which just defines the vectorial subgroup. The exact same thing occurs here. We have this being a diagonal, but now it's a 3x3 diagonal with its expectation value. It's normalized to be 1. But then we have that it has to have a diagonal subgroup as well. This SU3 left, SU3 right chiral transformations is breaking down to this vectorial subgroup. Okay, so it's an exact analogy. It's very similar to the custodial symmetry case. Okay, so wait, I think I missed some board. Okay. So as well as this being parameterizing the quark bilinears, we can just choose how we write it down. Okay, so since we broke an SU3 cross SU3 down to an SU3 vectorial subgroup, we had 8 plus 8 generators to start, and we break it down to something which is a vectorial subgroup where you just have 8 generators. So there's 8 broken generators. So we can just parameterize those broken generators in terms of some fields that we introduce. We introduce the field in this matrix M, and we normalize it by F, which people were asking about yesterday. So this normalization by F, what is F? So F is just a scale, which you'll see is key to the predictive nature of chiral perturbation theory. So it's essentially roughly 4 pi lambda QCD. And why is F appearing here? It's appearing here because we choose the kinetic term when we write it down in terms of this field sigma that we're going to parameterize our broken generators in terms of the Goldstones. We have an F here, right? So when we expand this term out to a bilinear term, which would be like a kinetic term for the mesons, then F squared will cancel this F squared, and we'll end up with the correct normalization for the kinetic terms. So you can, I mean, it's just a matter of consistency that F appears both in the exponential and also in the normalization of the kinetic term. Okay? So far so good. There's also lambda QCD. Now this matrix M, we basically take the 8 broken generators and we introduce fields that basically allow us to just expand this out in terms of 8 characterizing broken generator meson doublet fields. Okay? So far, we just introduce this as a parameterization. We'll identify them with the quarks once we put in the masses and that sort of thing. But you'll notice that it has a certain structure. Charge fields, which are going to be the charged pions, charge kaons, and the k0 k-bar. But we did something a bit weird here. For the neutral pion, we also introduced another field, eta. That gives us the total right number of broken generators being parameterized by fields. But the fact that we had to introduce, you know, an eta here in terms of these diagonal entries is going to come back in a second. Right, and we have to do a little bit more work to diagonalize the mass matrix. Okay, but this at this stage, this is just a choice. Okay, and just parameterizing the 8 broken generators. So if we want to actually figure out the mass spectrum, then we need to write down a mass term. Okay, so the masses we want to explicitly introduce as perturbations. The leading perturbation is order 1 in the mass matrix. And then what can we construct that has the right dimensions of dimension 4? Well, if we put the sigma field down, remember it didn't have any dimensions. It's this exponential. So we need this leading term to be of order QCD, lambda QCD cubed, which is what was V prime. Okay? So this makes it Hermitian conjugate as well to have this term as well as this term. And the normalization with the twos are chosen to have the right normalization for masses and kinetic terms. Okay, so it might not be obvious. Is it obvious to you at this stage what this theory is in expansion in? So it's an expansion in small masses, right? Because this is a perturbation. This mass matrix is a perturbation. But if we neglect these masses in the first place, we can also just ask ourselves the question, you know, what is this theory in expansion in? Any ideas? Opinions? Well, I wrote it here, so don't cheat. But so it might not be obvious, but before the masses, you can think it through. It's not just an expansion in masses, right? It's also an expansion in momenta over some heavy mass scale. Okay, so this is kind of obvious if you just think about the fact that you can write down higher derivative terms. So obviously there's higher order terms with higher powers of momenta around. And if you just think of this squared or cubed or to the fourth power, then the only scale in how we've constructed this term is f, right? So it's a double expansion. It's an expansion in p squared over f squared, and it's also an expansion in masses being smaller than lambda QCD. So there's more than one expansion here. So we've introduced this kind of weird field, this sigma field, which has this exponential. It's just a parameterization of symmetry breaking effects in terms of fields, but it really is an exponential, right? And so if we want to actually figure out scattering and the masses and the mass spectrum, then what we need to do is we need to take this exponential and we need to literally expand it, right? So, and we can also examine how it's actually a theory that's also an expansion in p squared when we do that expansion, okay? So let me know if I'm going too quickly. I wrote this out before because I wanted it to be very clear. Okay. So we know how to take something that's an exponential, a matrix of an exponential, and do an expansion, right? There's a leading term, which is just one. There's this term, which is the leading mass itself over f. F by choice in the exponential was there to make the kinetic terms all work out. And then we get square terms, and then cubic terms and fourth power, always going with f. All right? So if we take this term alone, which has this f square leading, we can do that expansion. And if we just go to second order where we plug in both of these mass matrices, so we go to this term and expand out both of these, then there's one term that we get which has this sort of form. These should be daggers. Okay, so what is that? Well, first of all, it has downstairs f to the fourth power. Whenever you have an m, you had a downstairs f, and we had a leading f squared. Okay, so this overall has mass dimensions 1 over f squared. There's two derivatives, and there's four of these m fields. Right, so the mass dimensions work out. And what is this? This is just a contribution to pion-pion scattering or kaon-kaon scattering in Karl perturbation theory. Right, it's a contact operator, but it's just in terms of Feynman diagrams, something like this, for example. Right? And you can see that this is got derivative factors. So if you put this down, this gives a p squared flowing through. So p squared over f squared. So you can see explicitly the expansion in p squared over f squared, as well as the expansion in mass divided by lambda QCD, which was our initial starting point. Okay, so remember I told you this f was roughly 4 pi lambda QCD. So if you actually take this and just sub it in, well, the scales of the p squared for meson scattering are probably going to be of order the meson masses, which is itself about lambda QCD. But this is still a very predictive theory because of this 4 pi relation, right? So this is why people sometimes say that chiral perturbation theory is a loop expansion. They mean this 4 pi in terms of this particular expansion behavior. It's not just that you can also do loops. You can do loops as well. Take this contact operator and you can do this. This is a perfectly well-defined quantum field theory. And you can actually have this operator appearing twice and then do a loop like this. So there's also like these loop corrections, but that's not what people mean by a loop expansion in chiral perturbation theory. They mean really this behavior in terms of f being 4 pi, so that this is where you get the predictive power of the theory. So in small mass limit and for small momentum, this should be a theory which is quite predictive because this is a small correction in terms of describing both the mass spectrum of the states and also scattering events and also the decays of mesons and the oscillations of mesons and one into another. Is that all clear? Chiral perturbation theory is a beast? Yeah?
Is it like 1 over a G expansion in the QCD coupling or something like that? Because, like, I guess that
1 over g expansion, well, because you're saying this comes from g fundamentally?
Yeah, something like that.
It's not, okay. So it's a very good question, which I don't want to have a very long answer to. So the reason I think you're asking that is because lambda QCD is generated by the running of g. Okay, that's true that it's generated by the running of g. So it's related to the coupling. And so there's a kind of intuition that this 4 pi is here because in some sense, in perturbation theory, when lambda QCD is generated, QCD has become strong, the loop expansion has failed. And when the loop expansion has failed, the loop expansion is, you know, G3, you know, over 4 pi squared. So you can say when the loop expansion fails, that G3 is being about 4 pi. So it gives people like a heuristic understanding of why this is here, okay? So, but beyond a heuristic understanding, you should be very careful because when QCD goes strong, strong coupling physics is something we do not have good intuition about. We're very used to perturbation theory. And when theories go strong, like QCD goes strong, it doesn't mean that all that's happening is that there's a large sum of Feynman diagrams that are all like the same size being added up together. Okay, so a lot of people think that's what it means when a theory goes over to strong coupling, that G just goes to 4 pi, and then that sum of Feynman diagrams is summed up to give phenomenology. And because we can't do that sum, that's why we start to do other techniques like to try and have descriptions of bound states. But that's not what happens when a quantum field theory like this goes strong. Even if you could sum up all those diagrams, you still wouldn't get all the strong interaction effects. There's, because the reason is essentially that there's an essential singularity that's present in the theory when the theory goes strong. So it's like the series doesn't converge, okay? So it's suggestive and heuristic that this is 4 pi related to when the theory goes strong. So this is kind of why that this expansion works. But you should be very careful with overinterpreting that kind of fuzzy understanding, because it leads to a lot of, you know, incorrect thinking in terms of what strongly interacting physics is. Is that clear? Okay. So it's a very, very subtle field theory point, but it's important to keep that distinction. Okay, so where are we now? Okay, so we're here. All right, so it's a theory which is p squared over f squared, but it's also a theory which by construction, which we were using to take the Goldstone bosons, insert the mass matrix, and then get the mass spectrum of the Goldstones, and then start to think about the Goldstones decaying. So let's do that. Okay, so if we take this term, where did I write it? Oh shoot, I didn't write it here. It's not here. It has to be here. Okay. Right, so we're gonna take this term now. We're gonna explicitly expand this sigma field to second order in the big M squared again, because we want a mass term, so we want a bilinear in the meson, right? Which will have linear dependence on the mass matrix and also V dependence. And then when we expand this to second order, we get two Fs downstairs, right? So just doing that explicitly, you get this mass spectrum for the states. I'm running out of time again. Okay, so we just take that, we just literally expand out, and we get the following masses. Okay, so we get, so it has the dependence you expect, F squared downstairs, V, and then you get mu plus MD. This eta P prime. And then the kaons similarly. Just with an MS. And then these guys. Okay. So this is just telling you the mass composition, the quark composition of the various pions, and the mass spectrum is going kind of exactly as you would expect. It's just an exercise. If you just expand it out, you'll find this is exactly what you get for the mass terms. But there's a problem in this. The problem is that it's not diagonal, the mass matrix. Now, why isn't it diagonal? It's because the eta and the pion, right? Here, right? No, I'm always guessing the wrong board. Right. Here it is. Right? It's because this term. So when we take this and we just literally do this exercise of plugging it in here and expanding it out, we get cross terms. When we go to the m squared, so we get cross terms. So there's a term like this. Yes, I think it's the square root of 2 f squared. Okay, so this is just a term which is proportional to the eta field and then the pi naught, right? So it's not a diagonal mass matrix. And it's not a big deal. There was no claim at the start it would be a diagonal mass spectrum in terms. We just were parameterizing the broken generators with those fields. And we can, of course, rotate our fields to be diagonal with these corrections. But this is actually a small correction because it's mu minus md. So mu minus md is much, much less than ms, which is present in this eta. So we can actually expand in mu minus md over ms, and then just neglect this term if we wish, or introduce those corrections further. And it's a good expansion. Remember, this was like 95 MeV, and this was like 5 and 2, right? So, I mean, it's a small correction. So essentially, the mass spectrum is approximately diagonal when you neglect these sorts of corrections. And if you are worried about them, you can just rotate what you mean by these fields to go to an explicit mass diagonal structure. If you ever have, just like the photon and the Z, if you ever have two fields that are not mass diagonal, you can just introduce a rotation matrix to go to a diagonal set of fields. It's always the case. Okay, but there's a further subtlety here in the eta. So it's made of the strange, the up, and the down as well. So it has both, it has those flavor threes. It's a 3-bar-3 bound state. And you know, 3-bar-3s is an 8 and a 1. So it's actually an eta 8 and an eta 1 that you can decompose in terms of the flavor octet and flavor singlet, which is just defined in this way. Okay, and just like I was just saying for the pion and the eta itself, you can always diagonalize, right? So we just introduce essentially mass diagonal states for that decomposition with a mixing angle, which we can always do. This isn't the Weinberg angle, it's yet a different angle. From eta 1 and eta 8. And this angle, in case you're curious, is about like minus 11 degrees. It's just something you can introduce and rotate to these mass eigenstate fields. So what is the mass spectrum and how does it work? Is chiral perturbation theory kind of being predictive? Well, this is about 130 MeV. And it's quite similar in mass. Well, it's the same expression, right? But remember, it was only because actually the up and the down, the difference of them was much less than the strange quark. If the strange quark had a very different mass, you wouldn't have such a good relationship between the charged and neutral pions. So it's actually a bit of an accident in this particular limit that's the case. And then the kaons, it's 490 MeV. And then this K naught, very similar. So far everything's just working swimmingly, right? If you think about the scales that we've introduced and you think about the masses that we were talking about the first day for the up and the down quark, which you would have to ask, how do we know those masses? And of course, they're by studying mesons consistently, that sort of thing, but let's just take them as a given. It's working very well as a theory which basically is describing the mass spectrum. But there is a bit of a problem, which is here, because the mass of the eta prime is 957 MeV. The mass of the eta is 547 MeV. So that's not working well at all. So what's that, is what people asked in the 70s. That was curious, right? We had such a predictive theory that had a very good understanding in terms of the expansion parameters, and then we had this very weird mass splitting between these states, which are just different decompositions of the same flavor triplets. So it's kind of weird. Why is there such a big splitting? So I'm going to not go into that in detail because I want to talk about other things in more detail. This is, so you remember last time we talked about how is there an axial symmetry? Okay, so if you go back to the kinetic terms and you think about the projectors and you expand out take out the gamma 5, then you might think there's a U1 that's present for just gamma mu gamma 5. And if you do the phase rotations of the kinetic terms, you might convince yourself that symmetry is present when you take opposite signs of phase rotations for the lefts and the rights. Okay? It looks like a symmetry that's there, that axial U1, at tree level in the theory. But when I first wrote this down, of course, there's the counter terms, because you always have to define the theory with loops. And that is an example of something that's just an accident at tree level, which when you start to do quantum corrections, there's the symmetry was never really there. It just was an accident of how you wrote it down at tree level. So when you start to do loop corrections, there's no symmetry protection. So why are symmetries predictive? Why are symmetries useful? Symmetries are predictive, they're predictive because even when you do loops, you have the same symmetry breaking parameters coming in, right? So I was saying this at the start for a reason. All of the symmetry breaking in the standard model is coming from VCKM. And even when you have the Z, which had the dressing of the W, which was leading to further flavor chains from the neutral current at loop level, it's all coming from the same, you know, symmetry breaking effects. Those are parameters which are breaking the symmetry, all descending from this. The axial anomaly is not like that. Okay, you have an accident at tree level, and you start to do loops, and there's no protection in the loop, so it's not proportional to, you know, any symmetry breaking parameter at tree level. It was a fake. Okay, and that's why there's no loop protection for the axial symmetry, and that translates into something Tuff studied. You can look this up. It's called the axial anomaly. That translates into there being a much larger effect here in terms of loop breaking of what you might think would be a degeneracy in the mass spectrum. Okay, I'm not going to go in detail about it, but it's descending fundamentally from that anomalous symmetry. You can look it up. Tuft could have gotten many, many Nobel Prizes. He did a lot of amazing things in the 70s. There's like a two-year period where his papers are unbelievable. Every single paper is just amazing. And this is an interesting story involving the axial anomaly. But I'm just going to leave it at that. Okay, so, all right. I guess I'm just going to talk a little bit about meson decay, and then we'll get into meson mixing next time in the GYM mechanism. Is that clear so far? Okay. So the mass spectrum works pretty well. So we think we have a pretty good understanding of mesons as bound states. And of course, we make a copious amount of them in experiments. And we can study their decays, whether they're clean decays to leptons or decays to other mesons. We have an enormous amount of data of this form. And it's useful to study them because they actually give us access to the CKM matrix. And we can look at consistency testing the standard model flavor-changing effects. Okay, so remember, that we talked a lot about this G Fermi. And just like this decay happens, you also have the same thing with quarks, but with downs and ups, with this VUD. And the only difference is, at this stage, that there's just an extra normalization in terms of this decay, right? So if we just take this and turn it so that we have these guys embedded in a meson, we can start to extract CKM parameters by studying clean leptonic decays of mesons, okay? So that's the first thing people were doing around the 60s and such. So for example, the pi minus. D bar U. And then U. So this gives you VUD. And you can also do things like this. Right, pretty clean decays, just going through a single W, giving you access to two individual CKM matrix elements. These decays, you can just, there's a general formula for these, which is just, if you have a meson going to a lepton neutrino, it's just G Fermi squared 8 pi. Then there's some F, which I'm going to define for you. The lepton mass of the meson, a phase space factor, and then this CKM element that had to do with the individual quarks, quark 1, quark 2, squared. So what's this? Another F. It's not the exact same F as before. Just so what it is that it's a decay constant for a meson. So its definition is that when you take a vacuum state, depending on your meson, you'll have either this and it's defined equal to I P mu. So this is the momentum that the meson is carrying. And then this FM for the meson. And you can have this also with right, as well, just for axial mesons that actually have this current, okay? So it's just a parameterization of how the quarks are embedded in this meson wave function. So it should remind you a lot of the things we talked about in terms of PDFs. So whenever you have a bound state object like this in QCD, and you have constituent quarks, we cannot calculate the overlap of the constituent quarks and the wave function of the bound state structure. We just parameterize it. In the case of scattering at LHC, for proton scattering, we were parameterizing it in terms of PDFs. So this is just a parameterization for a meson. It's an overlap of the wave function. Okay, and these things are of order 100 MeV. And we have to just extract them from experiment. The same, you know, meson decay constant appears in multiple places. So we have to, so we actually still have predictive power even though we're doing that. Okay? All right. So the next thing you would think to study, which is the next thing that happened historically, was something a little more complicated for the properties of mesons, because we have to, you know, examine other decays to try and get access to other CKM elements to see if this whole flavor-changing structure is holding together for the standard model. Okay. So probably the next thing you would want to do is you could do this. So you could take a kaon going through an up and something more complicated, but still has W's. All right? And this would be sensitive to both two CKM matrix elements. It would be US for this up S vertex and VDS. So this was directly calculated, clean leptonic decay of the kaons. And how would you think this would go? You would think the amplitude would be kind of simple. It would just be, if you just took this guy directly, it's like 1 over 16 pi squared. And there's going to be the propagators for the W. Now, I've told you many times that if you can expand the propagators for the W, it simplifies the problem a lot, right? So here at P squared is like the mass of the kaon, much, much less than the mass of the W. So we'd want to do that expansion. So that means you're going to get MW to the fourth power, G to the fourth power, 2. Then you'll get VUS, VUD dagger. Sorry, this is a dagger. Oh, this should be, this is UD. And then you have some overlap of some kaon wave function. And then you get the leptonic part. These are just the leptons. So we're trying to take this, and we're trying to shrink this to a point. But it's not as simple as the case where we had the tree level W, right? Remember, we had the tree level W over here. You just shrink it down to a point. There's really, and even here, there's really not any sort of complication. No, it's just a 4 Fermi vertex. Same here. But here there's 2 of these W's, and they're in a loop. So what if we shrink this to a point? What does it look like? Because we're kind of doing that here in this expansion. Well, so now it's going to be, these guys want to come in to kind of form a 4 Fermi vertex. And then this, you want to get into the meson. But what do we do with this? Which was the up quark. So you have to be a bit careful here in terms of what you're doing. So the only mass scale in this problem, you also notice that here the dimensions aren't quite right. Right? So you have dimensions coming out of here, these form factors. but you also have quark masses around. And so the relevant question is, what mass factor should go here? What mass dimension should go here? It's not obvious, but this is the clue in terms of how you should think about things. So if we took this full answer, and we calculated this full decay, and we squared everything and calculated this whole decay rate, then we could then take the expansion at the end, right? So if we take the expansion at the end, then what we'll find is going to be proportional to the mass of the quark, in this case, the mass of the up squared. And this will be squared too. So what you have to do to actually figure out the correct power of the mass, you would think it might be just linear, right? Because it's just the mass and the propagator. But it's not that simple. Because it's actually coming in here in terms of this loop, you have to do the expansion and match. When you do the expansion and match onto the effective operator, all of the mass scales that come out of this are the same. It's just parameterizing the quarks, the valence quarks, interactions with the meson wave function. So that cancels out in the matching, whether you calculate this or you calculate this. And to make up the mass dimensions, you actually have to get that this is a quark mass squared. It's not obvious, especially when you think of it in terms of the mesons, but that's actually how it works out if you do the full matching calculation, which is a bit of an involved thing. If you look in the literature, this is like was causing a lot of confusion around the time of these people figuring out this Jim mechanism. There's all sorts of statements of saying things like you have to regularize the loop integrals, and so mass factors come in regularizing the loop integrals. What it really means is that when you shrink this down to a point, you have this closed loop, and the only mass scale is the quark. So that's why you actually end up with two powers of the mass here.
All the hadronic masses for the wave function overlap stuff cancels in the matching function. So, people calculated this.
What they found was actually quite a significant disagreement with experiment, which is the up quark. I guess I should give up on that. And this was the first clue that you had to be a bit careful, and you had to think about what about other quarks actually running in this diagram. This was actually one of the inferences of the charm quark, the first one, before they explicitly discovered it. So if you had a charm quark here, you would get not VUD, you'd get VCD, and you wouldn't get VUS, you'd get VCS. And remember I made that whole point to you about how these are not all independent. And we had that Wolfenstein parameterization at the start showing the relationship between the terms. And there were signs in the off diagonals. And that's exactly what happens here when you actually take this and you actually sum over the quarks. You get and there's a relative sign between the two. So you actually get an m up minus m charm squared scaling over mw to the fourth power. Okay, and this actually changes the normalization in such a way as it actually becomes consistent with the experimental result. This was the first evidence of the charm quark, because when they just calculated this with just the up quark, it was so off from experiment. This general idea that when you have the CKM elements, you get the quark factors in the numerator. And also when you have combinations of the CKM matrix elements, you can get relative signs. That is actually what is called the Jim mechanism. And it appears in multiple diagrams, not just this one. Okay, so I'm going to stop because I'm already over, and I'll show you in more detail this and then also the meson mixing that this shows up in as well. But you can see that we're getting to a very unusually predictive pattern in terms of flavor changing effects. Whenever you have these amplitudes, you get these CKM factors, and you also have masses. There's 16 pi squareds around. So it's actually a very predictive pattern that when you study lots of different meson oscillations and meson decays, that you actually have a very non-trivial test of the flavor changing structure of the standard model. So I'll talk more about this next time. I'm already over. Are there any questions on that though? Yeah?
It's not still clear to me how the CK matrix exactly breaks the symmetry.
It's just linked to off-diagonal effects.
Okay.
So if we don't have, any masses, if there's no masses at all, then we have the full flavor symmetry group. Okay? As soon as you introduce masses, you tie the left and right-handed helicity eigenstates together, right? And then you don't have those SU3 rotations, the up and the down and the Q individually rotating by those SU3s. So the mass terms are, breaking the flavor symmetry down explicitly to subgroups.
Okay.
So this is an overlap matrix which has to do with the rotation from the weak to the mass eigenstates. So it's appearing in this linked way with the masses. So it's associated with the flavor symmetry breaking pattern. Remember, there's only 4 parameters in the CKM matrix, so it predicts many different experimental results. So it's highly predictive and highly constrained.